of medications. So my question is, the mind being non-physical.
Yes. I wouldn't say that yet. Did we?
Well, over the 16 years coming to Kadampa Center,
I know, but I'm trying to keep some other people's in suspense. you're stealing my thunder.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No,
but I can't say that I can't pose my question without assuming that. So, how does the
medicine work?
Yeah, the physical changing the brain chemical.
Okay, we'll talk about that.
Okay.
So, perfect. I think that comes this morning.
Okay.
And then make sure I answer the question, okay, as best I can. Anybody else have, everyone have a drink? Because I don't want to drink on by myself. Okay. So excuse me while if I do drink. If everyone gets a little cup, I can share it. Okay. So that question is really, really important and very germane to what we're talking about. I thought maybe it's good to situate it in when we get to that part of the discussion. Because medication is sort of a big deal in our culture, isn't it?
Yeah.
But then there's the broader question of the relationship between the physical and the mental, and so that's good. Okay. Anything from yesterday? Specifically, no. It's clear. We didn't get too far, but okay. So what we're talking about. So I think the, in order to put this also in context or remind ourselves, it's a very, very tough transition to make as to what really happiness is. If we can get to the point where we accept that every living being is trying to be happy, then the next step is, you know, that's not too big of a step. But to go from that to what it means to be happy is, I think that's a bigger step. I think even day to day we don't, and if you're like me, you know, don't even remember that we're talking about mental happiness as happiness, and that the situation for mental happiness, we could say, is mental health. And then we can begin to talk about, well, what is mental health? That's a really important question. Okay, so that's what we're doing here, really. That was the intention behind the misleading mind, was because I myself was frustrated at the different ideas, or the confusion, actually, around mental health and what it means to be, you know, what even the meaning of psychology is and what the intent is behind it and that sort of thing. Okay, so I'm sure you want to see a different slide. If you have a psychology, or if there's a theory of psychology, I'm trying to think, is there any theory of psychology that doesn't have a theory of therapy? Is it, you know what I mean? Is it merely philosophical? Or is it merely theoretical? Can you think of any? I mean, I don't think I can. Like, any system of psychology or assistance that doesn't have a theory that doesn't have a practice behind it? I'm sure it's not something we would normally think about, but if you think about it for a moment, I mean, philosophy in the Western modern, well, not in the Western or European sense, philosophy wouldn't necessarily have a practice with it, would it? Yeah. Would psychology? Always has a therapy, doesn't it? I think. I haven't thought of a... So it's a little bit different than philosophy in the sense that psychology will carry an intervention of some sort. But philosophy doesn't. It doesn't always. So in the Buddhist sense, of course, philosophy does carry a practice or a therapy, right? And psychology does carry, Buddhist psychology does, like all psychology, I think, all theories. I can ask David now that he's coming in. Can you think of a, and Karen, can you guys think of a psychological theory that doesn't have a therapy accompanying it? See, he probably never thought of it.
Huh? Psychological therapy.
A theory.
Psychoanalysis
is a theory, right?
But psychoanalytic perspective, and psychoanalysts never refers to it as therapy.
But it is therapy. It's an intervention.
What about positive psychology? Is that a therapy or an intervention?
Well, if you have a theory of, if your theory is positive psychology, aren't there positive psychologists?
Yeah.
As a goal. Yeah.
But do they have a, is there a system of intervention specifically? Yeah, I think so, for positive psychology.
Yeah.
And I think psychoanalytic theory, despite what they might say, you do go into a psychoanalytical therapist, right?
Psychoanalysts.
That's what I mean.
Never refer to themselves as therapists.
Well, that's okay. But I mean on a, that's just their thing.
Okay.
But they have a, an intervention, right? Okay. Their intervention is you lie on the couch and you free associate and they sit behind you and that's right. I mean, they have a way of helping you. They have a system, right? Or is it just theory? Philosophy is often just theory. Think about it. She doesn't agree with me yet, so. That's okay, you don't have to agree.
What I was thinking about, that any relationship, then there is for is an intervention. The minute you interact with someone, it's an intervention.
I guess I would say a structured or a organized intervention.
Yeah. I'm thinking about it. It's a good thing to think about.
Yeah.
I'm thinking.
Okay.
I'm thinking.
So in Buddhist, in the Buddhist system of thought, much of it, as I mentioned, is psychology. I think the Buddhist, what Buddha himself taught is collected into three different collections, right? We call this three baskets. Right? Technically, that's what they're called. So these three collections of all the Buddhist teachings fall into one of those three. And I had always thought that, and I still think, that all of those three collections, all those 100 volumes that fit in them three, I have this sort of romantic notion that they're all psychology. Because if the central purpose in Buddhist practice is to develop a healthy mind, then could there be anything that Buddha taught that wouldn't be designed to develop a healthy mind? I don't think so. Now, they're labeled like one of the baskets. So His Holiness Dalai Lama has said, read recently, he himself in one of the, can't remember where it was, but he himself said that he identified that two of those collections are clearly psychology. And he said the third one is usually described as the teachings on ethics. Vinaya is in the Sanskrit word. So the teaching on ethics, but if you think about ethics, why ethics? For people who never thought about it or don't know this, the ethics in Buddhist ethics, which is the class we're not going to talk about Buddhist ethics specifically, but the whole idea of Buddhist ethics is designed for what? Protection of what?
Mind.
Yeah. So there's no Buddhist, if you really study the ethics, there's no ethics there that is articulated because it's right. You shouldn't kill because killing is wrong. It's not articulated that way. The ethics are always articulated in the sense of what protects the mind, you know, what creates a healthy mind. I think that that's very, 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 not just important, but helpful. So when we are teaching other people or explaining to other people about why we don't kill, or you know, it looks very ethical, it can look religious. If you can identify it, if you can link it with the mental attitude that accompanies the ethics or the breaking of the ethics, and how, you know, then it becomes a very rich conversation. You know, it's a much richer conversation. Richer, I mean, in the sense of helpful, probably, in learning. To talk about not killing as a methodology to create a more healthy mind, or to protect the mind from being unhealthy. Now, in a just a casual conversation, that's a little tricky, because you might have to get into the philosophy, right? You know, the philosophy of, like, you're just saying to someone, well, you know, you shouldn't kill because it really makes your mind berserk. It does do that, killing. But you can't say it that way, because the link might be a bit distant. But, you know, most people in our culture are not familiar with the functioning of their minds, right? There's a lack of awareness, self-awareness, otherwise, you know. And I was reading, you know, Lama Yeshe used to say that Buddhism, so the intervention, if it's a psychology, then it has to have a therapy. Okay, what's the therapy in Buddhism?
Meditation.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Meditation. Which I often try to refer to as mind training. Because meditation sometimes is very specific. But we have a vast... Meditation is one part of mind training, we could say. It's the main part. But you could also, like, debate, you know, and contemplation, and those things are also mind training, if done with that intention. So Lama Yeshe say that meditation, why is it the therapy in Buddhism? Is because what is meditation? So meditation, one way of looking at it, I think the primary way to look at it in terms of this context, the word meditation in Tibetan is gom, the word is gom. I think it's so helpful to look at the word gom, as we mentioned one night, means to become familiar. We never hear meditate, you know, you never see in the literature, I mean, the common literature, like if you tell people mindfulness, well, what is mindfulness? Oh, it's meditation. Oh, well, what does it do? Oh, you know, I find it really good for my stress. Okay, that's not meditation in the Buddhist context. Okay, Buddhist context means to become familiar. So you could be practicing mindfulness and not becoming familiar, couldn't you? If you're just spacing out, Rinpoche asked this question once, Lama Zopa Rinpoche. If you're spacing out, meaning you're meditating, kind of spacing out, is it virtuous or non-virtuous? What do you think? Well, we haven't talked about virtue or non-virtue, but does it produce happiness or not? You ever thought about it? Do you any people space out in their meditation? I like, thank you for being honest. It kind of feels good, right? It's like taking a bath.
Temporary relief.
Huh?
Relief.
Relief. So, is it virtuous?
Yeah.
It's not.
What is spacing out for you?
Oh, you don't space out, that means. You're the lucky one. Blank. Like, yeah. This is for the streaming thing. Just ask. You can ask me that.
Oh, what do you mean by spacing out?
Yeah, so that's a good question. That worries me that you don't know. No, we know. Spacing out is sort of I don't know, there's many, I'm just thinking to myself. It's like, you know it when you see it. What's that expression? You know something when you see it? What is that? Huh?
Pornography.
Oh, yeah, that's how it's used. Or, yeah. Thank you. I wasn't thinking it was pornography. I thought it was like some animal or something, you know, when you see it. spacing out is really it's a very dull mind, actually. And it probably comes when you're sitting in meditation, or you could not be meditating, when you're not aware of your thoughts. It's a lack of awareness, even though you think you're aware. It might start from being aware. So for myself, I'm spacing out. Maybe I'm focusing on something in meditation. And then I lose my object of focus. And my mind is in a sort of a comfortable state. And it sort of stays there. But there's a cloudiness, actually. Not clarity. There's not clarity. You know, when you have clarity, you could space out. even in the clarity. You could. It's a lack of, you know, when, well, you want to get technical. So in, when we talk about meditation, that's why mindfulness, I'm generalizing, but the movement in mindfulness is a little bit, well, it's very watered, often very watered down. So in actual meditation, when we practice Buddhist therapy, which is what this is, awakened psychology. When Buddhist therapy and meditation, you actually need three things. Okay? So, and this is what's often forgotten. In the mindfulness movement, and again, I'm generalizing, so I don't want to offend anybody, but generally what it means is non-judgmental awareness. I think that's one way mindfulness is explained. You know, this sort of open awareness. So that's okay, but that could be very much spacing out. Probably most of the time, I think, for people. Which feels good. And there's some benefit in the sense that, you know, you become more and more aware of your stress and your, just, you know, and your triggers and, you know, reactivity, things like that. So there's benefit. But real Buddhist therapy, which we'll say slash meditation or mind training, has to incorporate focus, discernment or discrimination, and recollection. They're not that, they are different. And that's why they're talking about three of them. So let's say that your focus is the breath. It's a very common one. So focus, breath. So you keep your focus on the breath. Discernment is the quality of your focus. There's part, a little tiny part of your mind that's aware if you're spacing out, like losing the focus, or distractions are coming in. So that's discernment. There's a part of your mind that is kind of watching that. So there's a vigilance. And then recollection really has to do with remembering the object of meditation, or the breath itself. So it seems like discernment and recollection are the same, but they're not. Discernment is actually discerning the quality of your mind during the meditation. Recollection is really being aware, are you losing the object? Okay. As we develop our practice, so just to add a little bit technical, technology to that, technicality to that. There's nine stages that we go through in developing concentration, single point in concentration, meditation, whatever you want to call it. There's nine stages. So those things, recollection and discernment, are very important because particularly discernment, we can think we're very focused. But there, what comes later and as we advance is subtle laxity, it's called, and subtle excitement, but particularly subtle laxity, which means subtle. What's another word? That's the technical term, laxity. The mind is too loose, and that's recognized through discernment. You could be sitting focusing on the breath for maybe even a couple hours. So one might think, oh, I've developed single point of I'm at the ninth stage.
Yeah.
But that discernment gets that there's a subtle, that's the last thing to go, is the subtle laxity. Okay? So that's what we need. So if you start with discernment and recollection from the very first day of your meditation development, you carry those. And by the way, discernment and recollection are also mental factors. So what happens is, as we develop those in our meditation, when you're out in your daily life, they're functioning too. You become aware that, oh, my mind's a little foggy right now, or, you know, my mind, I'm not focusing on my task, you know, I'm not here in the moment, whatever it is. You catch yourself spacing out, losing focus. And then as your meditation session becomes more and more refined, when you're out in the world, it just carries over. So you do meditate while you're out in the world. It's just a different kind of meditation. Definitely. You know, we talked about that the other night. There should not be a lack of correlation between your sitting practice, your therapy, and your life in the world. They should overlap. They should intersect. How about that? Okay? And that doesn't happen sometimes for a very long time. But there is no separation for this. There's no church on Sunday and the rest of the life, the rest of the week. This doesn't exist. I mean, it might exist by habit, but not in theory. Okay? Yeah, David.
So is this...
You got to use the mic. You have to use the microphone.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I hope this is helpful. I don't... Yeah? Okay.
So just in thinking of my own spacing out and how often that happens, it to me, it feels like a laxity with a lack...
Yes.
With a lack of focus.
I think right? So.
It's just... But I'm awake, but I'm just...
Yeah.
Floating. There's no focus.
I think so. I think to answer your question, because you asked about what spacing out means, I think that captures... I think it has more to do with the laxity mind than the excited mind. Okay? I think excited mind is very we might say very distracted. Even a laxity is a distraction also. But I don't think spacing out, just in the common use of the term, probably doesn't mean the excited mind. It could be. But you know what I mean? Excited mind, I tend to think it's sort of distracted. You're all over the place. Laxity is seductive, actually. It can be quite seductive, too.
I can recognize what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
I study Theravada meditation.
Yeah.
So when I'm doing my bowing, when I'm doing my practice,
mm-hmm.
prostrations,
mm-hmm.
I can see I would be doing things, saying things before,
mm-hmm.
or I forget.
Yeah.
You know, just the small steps.
Yes.
I could identify what you're saying.
Yeah. That might be a little more related with focus. Right, yeah. Anyway, we're just talking generally. If we get technical, then we can get technical. But I just want to get a sense of what spacing out means, okay? Now, awakened psychology, let's get back to this idea. Excuse me. Okay. awakened psychology. So this is, again, for my, you know, those of you who are longtime Buddhists and those who are new, doesn't matter. This is an important concept in that the goal of Buddhist, so we have, very clear, we have Buddhism is a psychology. Primarily it's a psychology. Of course, cultures make it into different religions or systems that fit their culture. You know, we can be clear about that. But my teacher, Lama Yeshe, was very adamant. When I said, remember I said about being able to explain these teachings to your mother? He would say that if you understand that Buddhism is universal, means universal principles, boy, that's much easier. You know, we might not see how but we got to go beyond. So when we talking about bodhicitta, or the awakening mind, we talk about emptiness, we talk about dependent arising. We talk about even prostrations. Remember the other day we talked about prostrations for a moment. I just try to discipline myself to see what the universal concept is there, or principle. And I just really encourage you to do the same, particularly as new. You know, Buddhism's new to America, relatively new. We're not established here yet. Now, if you're in Sri Lanka or in Thailand, you know, I don't think you have to... I mean, there's probably a place to ask that question, but they're really established. You know, they have it fitting within the... It's culturally aligned already. You know, we're not. So, if we think about Buddhism coming here, what's becoming our religion? What's our system of thought here? Let's just say America. These are really hard terms, because what's America? But... you know, in this modern culture of ours, what is the system of thought?
Trying to achieve?
Huh?
Materialism.
Yeah, and how is... I agree. And how has materialism been sophisticated? I can't say that.
Prosperity theology?
Prosperity theology. I'm looking for another word.
Consumerism?
I'm looking for another... Consumerism... And what was the first? Materialism are sort of byproducts of this theory. Well, they're not. They're related. But what is it I'm looking for? What's the religion?
Hedonism.
Huh? Hedonism.
Capitalism.
Capitalism.
Accumulation.
Et It's really a good trick to know the answer yourself.
Yeah.
Science.
Yeah.
Scientific theory, which is rationalism. Materialism, like you said. Materialism is, in a way, another expression of science. Isn't it? Scientists is based upon what's measurable, what's observable. I think that without intellectualizing, if you just think about people, what their system of thought is, I think you'll say it's rationalism or science. For example, let's say, I'm trying to think of a really sort of intense experience you might have. Maybe sickness or something. What's your immediate refuge? What do you immediately rely on? Yeah. Doctor. An expert. I said immediate because that kind of shows where we're at. After a while, I go, oh, wait a minute, okay, I get it. And then people go to God or maybe to Buddhism, their system. But if you think spontaneous, for a long time, right? For a long time, you're spontaneous. Like my dad used to say, well, you know, science will fix it. We used to argue with him about the pollution and all the cars. And he said, well, that's for your generation to figure out, but science will figure it out. You read the newspaper, right? Isn't that, and you look at climate change. What's happening? Science will figure it out. I mean, people don't necessarily feel secure with that, but that's where they go. Do you think science will figure that out? Okay, we'll leave that for now. So an awakened psychology means this psychology. So, I don't know if I have the slide here, so I'll jump ahead. And just say, I'm not sure I'm jumping ahead. In modern psychology, and again, we're just going to generalize for the sake of conversation and making a point. In modern psychology, modern psychotherapy, what is the goal? And make it very practical. You go to a therapist. What's the goal?
Bring you back up to normal.
Mental stability. Oh, I forgot the... I'll repeat it. One person said, what did you say?
Bring back to normal.
Yeah. Now say it.
Bring back to normal.
And then you said stability, right? Okay. Anybody else? Come on.
Being able to get by.
Being able to get by. Oh.
Identification of the problem so you can work to solve it.
I'll repeat when people don't have the microphone.
Just to function.
To function.
In a normal life, as you would think of it.
Okay. Function in a normal life. Those are pretty good.
To work and to play. The capacity to love.
The capacity to love.
The capacity to love, the capacity to work, and the capacity to play.
The capacity to love, the capacity to work, and the capacity to play. Is that Fritz Perl? Okay. Is that you?
No, it's Freud.
It's Freud. Boy, he was a good example of that. No.
He's talking about it as a goal.
Yeah, I know.
He didn't make it.
Isn't that it? No. Love. I like the love one. That makes sense. So, and those, I know I ask all the time, and I think it's only Kondrola now who's worked in mental health. Anyone else? Mental health? Right. So do you study the DSM 5, 4, 3? The DSM is the Diagnostic Manual. In other words, all the diagnoses are in there. And when you're, particularly in certain environments, like when I was working at Stanford, I had to apply diagnoses to people because you can't get your insurance to pay if you don't have a diagnosis, oftentimes. Now it's changing a little bit, thank God. But anyway, so people would, you'd have to diagnose people.
Yeah.
Okay?
Label.
Yeah. You have to pathologize them. Psychopathology. Now think about this as a system of thought. So in the DSM 5 or 4,
It lists all the mental disorders, so not physical ones. So my favorite always was trichotillomania. You know what that is?
No.
Carla, remember trichotillomania? It's such a, yeah, it's pulling your hair out.
Yeah.
But see? Uh-oh. No, it's okay. I won't ask you how you know. But what's interesting about
I've improved. I use a razor now.
Oh, okay. Yeah, me too. Trichotillomania, see, you might think that's a physical ailment. But it's not. It's not in the, what's the doctor's one? I can't remember the desktop manual, whatever it's called. Huh? Merg, yeah. Well, they get their diagnosis from. Yeah, it's not in there. Well,
International Classification of Disease.
I think the DSM now overlaps with that so that you can make a claim. You sometimes have to use ICD code. ICD, right? Yeah. Anyway, point is, it's considered a mental disorder, trichotillomania. But most of them are like bipolar disorder and manic depressive disorder, mood disorders, psychotic disorders. How many do you think there are in there? Anybody know?
Hundreds.
No, they're not Buddhists. How many do you think? Anyone make a guess? What do you think? Do you remember?
What was the question?
It's a trick question. How many diagnoses are in the DSM? I think it's 425. And in the DSM-5, which came out, 4 or 5 years ago, there was one enlightened person on that committee. And he said, we are adding no new diagnoses here.
Yeah.
You can increase the number. So what they did is they took some out so they could put the new ones in. But at least he did that. Otherwise, so in those 425, I think it's 425, might have something 497 or 425, something like that. How many? So there's the statistical manual, all the diagnoses. And I asked these two mental health practitioners, what was the diagnosis for health?
Absence of disease.
Absence of disease. When you look at the DSM, and I know this, when you look at the DSM, does it ever say what the goal is, or just say what to be free of? In other words, it has all the diagnoses. Does it ever say to get here? It doesn't, by the way. It does have a scale of functioning, right? Remember, there's scales of good functioning, poor functioning, you know. It's so relative. It's like, good functioning means you're not crying anymore and you can go to work, right? That's the good functioning. You're not depressed. You can go to work. Your life functioning is, your life actions, what's the word I'm looking for, are functioning. You're able to get up and make coffee in the morning. You can go to work on time.
Daily living.
Excuse me?
Activities of daily living.
You got all the good. Thank you for. Boy. Now, that's kind of sad, actually. Now, I know that there's many philosophies in our modern culture that are not related with that view. But if our religion and our priests are becoming therapists and psychology, we got to improve on that. Because just functioning is not really a great goal of life. We can do better. So,
I think the inherent shortcoming of all of these systems, not inherent, but embedded in them, is they're descriptors of a current state.
Yeah.
Of, you know, it's a snapshot in time.
So what does it say that you
it's
can achieve?
It's kind of you're assessing one mental moment. Well,
right. Isn't that sad?
Whatever the number of mental moments there are during the assessment time in the office.
It's sad.
And then that gets frozen in time.
Yeah.
Versus what you're talking about.
Well, and also that you can have a client come in, you know, innocent enough, and you're not a person that's going to say, you know, they're going to come in and just, again, I generalize a lot because it makes it a little easier, but they're coming in and say, I'm really depressed, you know, my husband left me, and I can't seem to stop crying, and I just, you know, I can't function. And so remember when I talked about the tiger hugging, you know, giving a hug? Sure, I mean, give me a hug, you might have to give a hug, but as a as a mindset, you're sitting there as a therapist, you know, someone that they're taking, in a sense, refuge in. And all you're holding in your mind is this person to be free of that emotional distress. That's very limited. And that's what most therapists sit in. You know, I'm not saying all, but it's very difficult to have in your mindset something beyond that. If you can, when you do, you know, you sit. It's really a kind of amazing experience to sit with someone who sees beyond your momentary struggle. That's what I say about Lama Yeshe, you know, and probably his holiness and Lama Zopa. I felt, you know, I said Lama Yeshe, one of the qualities was you felt hopeful. I felt because when he was looking at me, he saw my enlightenment, okay, my completeness. You know, I might be crying there or struggling or upset, and he's not captured by that. Because he has awareness of impermanence, he has awareness of it's an awakened psychology. So now we shift. Because in Buddhist psychology, that's the goal. And they know and they'll describe that there's a state of awakening. Okay? And when we say enlightenment, it sounds a little, I don't know about to you guys, but enlightenment seems a little bit far away. You know, a little bit up in the sky, unfortunately. That's probably our Judeo-Christian upbringing, you know. I don't think it works that way for the Tibetans, for example. But, so that's why I try to find a different kind of, like, awakening. Because Buddha means awakened. That's a literal translation. And in our culture, why do we call it Buddhism? It's a Sanskrit word. I think probably because English is so tolerant of other languages, right? But why don't we call it awakenism? I'm Buddhist. Why don't you say because it doesn't sound so good. I'm an awakening adherent. Now I know why you say Buddhist. Do you see what I mean? The point is, you know, these terms, words carry power. So I like the idea of being awakened, an awakened psychology. So it's a psychology where the goal is an awakened state of mind, and we won't say an awakened place like God, heaven. We don't say that because that feels outside. Awakened to me feels like something inside, you know, something part of my psychology. Doesn't it? So it seems a little more achievable. So that's the difference when you think about when you reflect upon Western or modern psychology and Buddhist psychology, think a little bit also, well, what's the goal here? And the goal in modern psychology is very vague. It depends on the system. I think we need now, we need a modern articulation of awakened psychology. We need awakened psychology. We need Buddhist psychology. We need Buddhist therapists. I don't like saying that because it sounds like religious. So, you follow me. And when I say that, I mean someone who understands psychology from the point of view of the Buddhist psychology or the awakened theory. We need that. That would be great service to so many people. And then we have to do it in a way that fits this culture, this language, whatever this culture is, and you know the English language. Particularly language that people can follow. Okay. So, we cannot say we're Buddhist just because we want to say we're Buddhist. And you can. But if we get strict about it, okay? The Tibetan word for Buddhist, I just use Tibetan word because it's helpful. I don't know what Sanskrit, Sanskrit would be Buddhist. The Tibetan word is Nangpa. Very revealing. So Nang means, anyone speak Tibetan here? Studied Tibetan? Nong means it's Tibetans. They don't say it's a case language, but it's, it has similarities to a case language. So Nong means inside or in. I-N.
Can you spell it?
It's right there.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Nong means inside, so it's been kind of a case language. If you say I'm going inside, you have a verb case marker dro, which means go, and Nong. So to say going inside, you say Nong dro. Now, this pa is a suffix in the case, which means a person or a being. So it's an inside being. Great word for Buddhists.
Yeah.
So instead of saying you're Buddhist, you need to say I'm an inner being. But it's not that easy. Generally, say Buddhist means I follow the philosophy of Buddhism, which is okay. But if you're really a Buddhist, that's a transformation that happens at some point. Not necessarily when we start studying Buddhism, even. It might take years. Years to become an inner being. I mean, probably not, but it can, yeah. Because it's that thing about when you're in the car accident, let's say, or when you're in distress. Where does your mind go? Out or in? For solution.
Out.
We tend to go out.
Perfect.
Yeah. The doctor, the ambulance, or whatever. Or let's not even take something so drastic. Let's see, a real common thing.
If you fall down.
Well, even something more emotional, less physical.
Space out.
Space out.
You don't know what's happening for a minute.
No.
I had to relax.
So when you space... Oh, thank you. When you space out... Let's see if I can do this. This is why I like doing this job. Go ahead.
Space out in accident.
Space out in accident. What kind of emotional, what kind of problem do we face every day?
Anxiety.
Anxiety over what? Give me what's the context?
Work. The to-do list.
Okay. So just to repeat, anxiety, the to-do list, work. Anxiety over work. So my guess is the anxiety arises before you get to work. Maybe. You're thinking about the night before, something like that, right? So what's your solution to that? What's a normal solution? Maybe you're going to watch TV, maybe listen to some music, maybe call your friend, you know, coworker, find out, you know, so what's expected of me tomorrow, and who is this guy I'm meeting, or how am I going to be in the meeting that I got to do this presentation, right? So you're not a Buddhist. If that's what you're looking for your solution, doesn't mean you don't do those things. I got to be very clear because I don't want to be too extreme. It's what's your default mode? If your default mode is to investigate how you're viewing the situation, you're getting caught by thinking it exists that way to cause anxiety, then that would be a Buddhist approach. Now there's many, many, many formulas you can use. Everything from emptiness to compassion to bodhicitta to exchanging self with thought transformation. There's 84,000. So we won't go there. But as long as it's somehow regard the actual problem is the disturbed mind. And so if it's a mental disturbance, and this comes up later, but if it's a mental disturbance, I'll just ask this question. If it's a mental disturbance, can it have a physical solution? Go into your thing about medicine. We'll get there. If it's a mental, if all of a sudden you turn it, see now, let's go back. Anxiety. Well, it's not a mental problem. It's because that guy who is my manager, who's so critical and condescending and never gives me any approval, is going to be in that meeting. That's pretty anxiety provoking. I feel all right now. Right? That's the kind of thing we make sense of it. That's not a spiritual approach. You are not a spiritual being at that moment. Or Buddhist. I use spiritual because, and explain what spiritual means. You're not an inner being at that moment. I think a spiritual person, my definition is anybody who seeks to develop their inner potential. And unlimited inner potential. So I didn't say Buddhist. You don't have to be Buddhist, quote Buddhist, to do that. Okay, it's having an acknowledgement that we have this whole inner universe, and it's not tapped, and it's not developed, it's not nurtured, and it's not our default mode. So when we say in the typical Buddhist literature about taking refuge. Yeah, refuge is not about thinking about Buddha and your guru out there. I mean, you can do that, of course, you know. But I think ultimately what we're talking about is going inward to those resources. So that Buddha awakened quality that is within us, or the potential of it, the guru's quality that's within us, that sort of thing. That's a higher level of refuge, if nothing else. We could say that going out... refuge to the outer Buddha, outer guru is refuge, it is. But truly as an inner being, it would be some sort of inner relationship. The thing that it says here, people at different levels. One year, one of my jobs at Kopan was, you know, I mentioned that we have this very well-known meditation course every November. Hundreds and hundreds of people come. In fact, now these days they have to close it to 300 people. You know, they have to limit it to 300 people. And when I was there, it was usually around 180, 150, 200. And so I was one, along with my wife, would manage these courses along with the Tibetan Sherpa, the monks there. You know, so we were like liaison between the Westerners and in the management, you know. So we were part of the management, helping organize these courses. And there was always, Lama Zopa Rinpoche in those days taught almost the whole course. So usually he taught twice a day. He didn't go on quite as long as he did in later years, but still each talk would be 2 to 3 hours. So he'd be teaching 4 to 6 hours a day. Lama Yeshe, then what would happen... Yeah, and then in between, you're doing meditation sessions and getting some other instruction. And that was always led by a Western student. I think always, more or less, always a monk or nun. And they'd be the course leader. And so it's a very intense experience. Because also you're getting up, it's a month long. Supposed to get in the second 2 weeks, you'd get up at 5 in the morning and do precepts and take one meal a day and, you know, not talk till noon and stuff. So it's rigorous. And these days it's not quite as, they've loosened up. But in those days, and you weren't supposed to leave, the Kopan's on the hill, and you weren't supposed to leave the hill, you know, it's all enclosed. And, you know, of course you didn't smoke cigarettes or, you know, get high and all those things. You know, you lived within the vows, and so inevitably there'd be people. Depending on who the course leader, some of the course leaders are very strict, and then other ones would be slightly more loose. And so one year that we had one Western American nun who was teaching, very, very big-hearted nun, and so it was kind of somehow they translated it. Got kind of loose. We heard people were leaving the hill and going and getting apple pie in Kathmandu and smoking cigarettes. I mean, you just hear these things. You know, it was very remote then. I mean, it was very isolated, I should say. So, you know, I remember going and talking to Lama Yeshe about this problem of people leaving and becoming kind of slack. And I thought for sure, I'm going to have an ally in my complaints, right? I don't know what it was with me. It took me so long to learn that whatever I did, I was going to get criticized for. But I kept trying. I was like, yeah, I don't know. I just hoping for a different result, right? So I remember explaining it to him and thinking, you know, he's going to rein in this American nun and tell her, you know, you need to tighten the ship up. I remember he looked at me and he just said, people are at different levels, dear. And that was it. So tolerant, so understanding. He didn't care. I mean, he cared, but he looked at the positive side, the people that maybe had a very difficult time being there were putting themselves in that environment for a month and trying and getting some benefit. And of course he cared about the overall rules and that sort of thing, but that wasn't the point. He wasn't being ruled by the rules. So people are at different levels, dear. So when I talk about inner refuge and then taking refuge, you know, of course, it depends on one's level, right? Sometimes also in absolutes. Only by investigating the nature of our underlying dissatisfaction can we come to see the whole story. And from that point, find a way out of our situation. Okay. We were talking the other night about some of the ideas, like with positive psychology and different kinds of consulting, appreciative inquiry. I don't know if people know about these things. And the work that I had, the kind of therapy I did, I felt very aligned with narrative therapy. They were not comfortable, they are not comfortable with looking at problems, particularly causes. The reason is because it's a reaction to what they see as more the oppressive pathologizing theories of, you know, earlier therapy and consulting. If you think about what we talked about, you know, a few minutes ago, you look at coming from Freudian theory on up to fairly recent time, it was about understanding the pathology. Then there are some movements in psychology that said, wow, you know, that seems very oppressive. And they are. They can be. It seems very oppressive, seems very negative, very problem-oriented, very pathologizing. So then people begin to identify themselves as their pathology. You know, and so, yeah, I'm a very depressed person. Maybe they don't say exactly that way, but that's how they begin to think of themselves. So, you know, there's the conversation around that they would have when they come into the office or in theory with psychology is a conversation around the pathology. And it still happens today, although there's a lot of movement away from that. I think that a movement away from that is a little bit tricky because I think instinctively, maybe it's just our culture, but instinctively we tend to think in terms of the negative. In fact, the science shows we're negative bias, right? So when we talk about pathology, it fits our probably instinctive habit, whatever you want to say, to think negatively. Okay? So that negative slant, well, what there was a reaction, many good people, of course, which was let me rephrase it. What has happened is a movement away from analyzing the problem, because the traditional therapies and approaches was to analyze the problem, the causes. And what happened with the causes in modern psychology, as we know, so if you're depressed, let's say, and you're involved in trying to understand depression, then in the traditional therapies and theories, how would that depression be explained? Depend on the theory, right? Depend on the therapist's theory. So some of the ways to explain depression, and I'm again generalizing, were you a psychoanalyst? Did you like that theory? That resonate for you?
Yeah, I was trained in lots of systems theory, and then Winnicott, psychoanalytic.
Okay, so we have theories like psychoanalytic theory. We have systems theory. We have family systems theory. We have narrative or constructivist theory. We have substance abuse theory. So in psychoanalytic, if that's your theory, then depression would be something having to do with the related. Again, generalizing, so just let me make my point. No, I know. You can argue with me too. would be something having to do, let's just say, traditionally with the relationship with your mother. Okay? If you were, then that evolved and you got Jungian was coming into the scene, who was had been a colleague of Freud, and then he started seeing it that a different way. And we started talking about archetypes, like you had in these sort of inherent, and that's inherent qualities. And so depression might be explained as a disconnect or something with the archetypes, the shadow and things like that, right? Unconscious, the relationship between the unconscious and the conscious or subconscious, like that. And then evolved, and you talked about systems theory. Well, pretty family systems theory. So then it became your family system was dysfunctional. Or maybe triangulation in the system, where you were triangulated between, you know, your father and mother didn't have much intimacy, and then they used you as a way to have intimacy, like that, right? These are theories to explain the depression. Okay? This is not a psychology class, that kind of psychology, so I'm not going to go into it. But just to give you an idea. So then you had narrative theory, or constructivist theory, which said, which was interesting, other systems, family systems, and the alcoholic model, or the addiction model, which was that you grew up in an alcoholic family. Yeah, but no one in my family drank. Yeah, I know, but you know, there was, what about their grandparents? Oh, yeah, my grandfather, yeah, he hit a bottle in the garage. See, so as a result, right? So you fit it into the alcoholic model. You got to make it fit. There's nothing wrong. People try to make sense of the world, and they get a philosophy or psychological theory, and then they try and... That's kind of the big activity of therapists, is the exciting thing. Let me figure out how this works. And we're going to figure it out together. Right? Don't they do it in that kind of part of therapy, is you figure it out together. So, so what's that saying? If you give a kid a hammer, everything becomes a nail.
Yep.
Okay. That's what happens. So then the constructivists came along, the narrative therapists, and they said, whoa, look at what's happening in the world of psychology. And they saw it in political terms, or rather power terms. And they watched the dynamic, the interaction between the client and the therapist, and said, you know, the problem is not your alcoholic father or your relationship with your mother. The problem is that the therapist himself is disempowering you. You're disempowered by the problem. So look at it in terms of power. The problem is overwhelming you. And your therapist is contributing to that, and so is your social interactions, contributing to your sense of powerlessness. It's not about, and so they would go, these psychologists have been oppressive to people, using their expert knowledge to oppress you and keep you disempowered. So we're throwing that out. Forget psychology. Okay? And in fact, there's a famous or a popular line in narrative therapy. Their line is, the problem is the problem. So if you want to know how you think about how you think problems are constructed. And a lot of times we go to my parents this and my parents that, don't we? In other cultures, they don't do that, by the way. So that's something learned. So what is the problem? Okay? So that's a long story about this quote. Sorry. So this quote is that, you see, that flies in the face of a lot of the narrative therapists, the modern therapists, positive psychologists, where they don't feel it's useful to investigate the problem. And I understand why, and I agree with them. Because when you're investigating problems from the point of view, those theories that are not, in my point of view, are not actually complete. I was going to say not correct, but it's not that they're not correct. Is they're not complete. They're not accurate.
They're narrow.
You know, and they're interpretative. They're based on projection of what you've studied, not on what the client's experience is. We should go from the client's experience. For the client's experience, the problem is the problem. It's a pretty good way to start. And then you begin narrative therapy, and that you begin to ask the client about being the expert on the problem. I love that. What I found as I did more work in narrative therapy is that while they might be the expert on the problem, they're missing information that could be really useful to getting out of the problem. It's very delicate because the information you might share with them, so there's an educational component. And then if it's educational, what are you educating them in? Are you educating them in a what I would call wrong theory, family systems, you know, it's all, or alcohol, I mean, addiction, or, you know, psychoanalytic. Well, that's what happens if you don't have an understanding of what, I'm biased, right, of what really is going on. Which, for me, I've only found Buddhist psychology as the clearest, deepest, most extensive explanation of what's really going on. Now, to translate that for a client is a different story. That you have to be very careful. Because you could be repeating the same power dynamics as other theorists, right? And that happens amongst our Buddhist friends. It happens all the time, and this is kind of a personal plea to move beyond that. Because, you know, it's like I go to David and say, you know, Dave, yeah, I'm really struggling with this, you know, this guy at work, and David says, oh yeah, what's just your karma? Is that any different than a therapist who says, well, it's because of your relationship with your mother?
Yeah.
Could be different, but the way it's experienced is not different. It's just another theory that he understands his theory, but it's not in my reference. So he needs to educate me. Rather than say it's your karma. Or, you know, like that. You have to actually be more personal. Much more personal. Okay? So be careful. Our theories are not just supplanting other theories. Theories might be kind of correct, but the effect of them on other people is not that much better. Not necessarily, right? Do you understand what I'm saying?
It doesn't help.
It doesn't necessarily help them unless you can educate them. So there's an educational component to therapy. That's my, I think. You okay? Do you need a break? Well, we're going till noon, I think.
Yeah, we're going till noon.
Noon, right? Okay. We already talked about this. Mind training. So mind training is a therapy of Buddhist psychology. And I already explained that the word gom in Tibetan means to become familiar. So when you're meditating, guys, in a Buddhist sense, you're becoming familiar with something. Okay. Big part of it is becoming familiar with your own psychology. How your mind functions. Very refreshing idea about meditation. Now, of course, there's meditation that is not about becoming familiar. It's about spacing out. Bliss. Feeling good, right? So, in Buddhist psychology, those are definite experiences, but they're byproducts. The goal is not, I'm going to meditate to feel good. And that sounds like a kind of a downer. But the byproduct should be feeling better and better but we're looking over years or months, not by the meditation session. It should not be our goal that when we sit, we're going to feel better when we get up. Why do I say that? I mean, probably you will, but you might not. And I said that's not our goal. So in the traditional sense of Buddhist thought, now this is not actually, I'm stepping out of the program for a second. In traditional, just to help clarify, in traditional Buddhist practice, in Tibetan Buddhist practice, we say, I don't know, Mahayana practice, I'm not sure, is that there are three different levels of motivation. Okay? And if your motivation is what they talk about in religious terms, the happiness of this life, what that really means is, you know, your goal has something to do with something very temporal, either today or tomorrow, you know. And generally, if we can check, when we sit to meditate, and if it's to feel good, then that's for that temporal, that's not a Buddhist motivation. The very least, it says for the future life. Now, again, that's tricky because that takes some acceptance of future lives, but at least something that's not in the immediate present. That you see it as a developmental process. Okay? So that's why I'm going back to it's to become familiar, yes. But motivation is the thing. When we sit and you do your psychotherapy in the morning by meditation or mind training, we're supposed to motivate. That's what protects that meditation. So the motivation is at least to have develop a clarity of mind for a permanent state of clarity and mental health. So when you say that, you really are very clear. It might not happen this session. I mean, most likely it's not going to happen this session. But it's a process. So meditation then seen as process rather than as a one-off. So it's process. And then your mind goes, well, process means, if you think process, it means some sort of longer-term goal, doesn't it? It's a project. So when we do our morning, when we do our practices, it's really important to think that way, that this is a process. And if I feel better at the end or not is not the issue. I mean, hopefully you do, because why not? But you might not. But you might be more knowledgeable, more aware, more familiar. That should be that's a good thing. Feeling more familiar is the point. Feeling more familiar usually ends up meaning you feel better, but not 100% guaranteed for that day. Okay? Because this is sometimes it's a struggle, right, to get through these issues. It is transformative. That's the other part of it. What means transformative is your mind is transforming from its ordinary psychology to an awakened psychology. Okay? It's a process too. It's not like I'm unawakened and someday I'll be awakened. I mean, someday you will be awakened. But you know the mind is awakening. And for some people that awakening process might be several lifetimes. Some people might be one whole lifetime. Some people might be 3 years. We can't say. Generally, it's a while. You know, it's not something instant. But progress should be noted. You should be able to notice progress over time. Okay? So, when I was 18, I just graduated from high school, and I received my first Buddhist teaching. I was taking a year off before going to college, and I was working for my brother-in-law. Who along with my best friend Dave. So Dave gave me my first Buddhist teaching. Dave, you know, I grew up outside Los Angeles. I was of the surfer hippie crowd. I guess there were some of us that kind of combined the two. It seemed like you're one or the other, but I was in both cultures. And so, you know, our thing at that age was either surf or get high. Sometimes together. So there was Dave. I don't know, anyone familiar with that surf culture? Then back in those days? So there was a uniform we wore. The uniform was blue jeans, blue tennis shoes, Keds, right? And then either a white or a blue t-shirt. And unfortunately, I was so jealous of Dave because he had the blonde hair. And his nickname was Scarecrow because his hair was always... He always looked like he slept in his car. He may have too. But, you know, T-shirt hanging out, actually sagging, long before sagging became popular. And so we'd have to be into work, whatever, 7:30. And the work was installing vertical blinds, which are you have in your house, you know, installing those things. And that was before they were, well, they're just starting to go into homes, but before that, it was all commercial buildings, and we go into these big buildings, and, you know, but we made great money for teenagers. I mean, it was really, really good money, so we could buy our dope and go surfing and have parties, and then, you know, and show up at work next day. And so there's David, and I remember we were stocking up for the day, you know, looking at the orders, getting the parts we needed in the storeroom. And my brother-in-law ran the installation part of that company. The company was the vertical blind company. And so we go in there, and my brother-in-law was very ambitious, very organized. He made it very clear he was going to be a millionaire by the time he was 30. And I think he was. He did become a millionaire, and it's close to them. And not a very happy guy, but nice guy. And so he was very hyper-vigilant about running this part of his business, you know, super organized and efficient and, you know, whatever model he had for running a good business. And there was David and me, right? So David was, you know, like I said, usually looked like he just got out of it, sleeping in his car. And so there he was, his hair is kind of unkempt, down to his shoulders. And so we came in, we're sorting out the equipment we needed and the parts and the various orders. And my brother-in-law said, "Look, I got to go out for a few minutes. Don't answer the phone." You know, So then I'm in the back room getting the parts, and I hear Dave yelling. Yeah, I go, "What's going on?" And I go into the store, and right when I go, I'm in the office, I'm like, right when I go in this door of the office, my brother-in-law came into this door of the office, like with his panic look, because he could hear Dave also. And there's Dave standing with the phone like this, and he says, "Problems? Problems? Lady, everybody's got problems." And he slams the phone down, and my brother-in-law's face was like white. "Who was that?" He says, "Oh, it's some lady yesterday. We installed her blind. She said they fell off the rack." And so I say, Scott was this. But that's why I learned my... So I extrapolated. My first Buddhist teaching. Problems, lady, everybody's got problems. So people think of Buddhism as sort of negative, don't they?
Yeah.
Problem-oriented or suffering. So I have a question for you guys. What's your definition of problem?
When things don't go the way you want.
Okay. So I'll repeat if you don't. When things don't go the way you want them to. What's another, what other person's like, you think, did you have a good day? No, I had a terrible day yesterday. So quickly, why was it a terrible day? What's a problem?
Your mind is disturbed.
Your mind is disturbed. Is that a common way of thinking of problems?
For me, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, your mind is disturbed. Just say, do you think generally the life is problematic? Is that kind of a negative thing to say? Some people say yes. Do you generally think life is problematic?
Someone here said once that, you know, everything is suffering, everything is a problem. You can go through a drive-thru and order a ham sandwich and they're going to mess it up. So,
mm-hmm.
I mean, don't expect it to be right. So everything is a problem or has the potential to be,
okay.
You know, our definition of a problem.
So, you know, we could, you know, when you hear that, you think, God, well, don't be so sensitive. Right? It's a ham sandwich. And then you go, so, you know, it's a little bit like in Seinfeld or Larry David, you know, he's a good example that everything's a problem because he's so, like, reactive. But not everyone's like that. He's a good example that, because he can, anything can be a problem for him. I think that's very helpful. But, you know, other people say, it's just a ham sandwich. And I get so impressed with people who are so... My wife's from Australia, and also in Nepal, you use your horn a lot. And she just can't believe it in California. I don't know about out here, probably the same. She says, I can't believe people are so patient. They don't use their horn. You know, someone's going 25 and a 40, and no one's honking at them. And then the guy who honks, oh, he's got a problem. But people who are not honking, see, they're not in a pro- they don't have a problem. Right? So what does it mean? So it's funny, problems. It's usually we think of as situational. And some people have less problems because they're less reactive. Right? Okay, that's not what it means. unfortunately, I wish it was that simple. But now, let's look at first. So generally speaking, people think of problems as situational, right? Out there. Not entirely, because of course we have the deep problems like, you know, a child sick, or, you know, loss of a loved one, and, you know, everyone can agree how those are problems. But situational is generally seen as, again, we go to the philosophy of modern culture. In the philosophy of modern culture, because we already spoke about it being a materialistic, a rational, materialistic, we're of course using in a neutral sense, not he's materialistic. It means that you see material as a source of happiness. And then also material is then seen as a source of problems. I think it's fantastic. I mean, it's just amazing that we have to be so honest. I mean, I don't know if I'm Buddhist yet, honestly. I really don't. Because when I think of a problem, I usually think the problem is outside of me. I was reading the news a couple of days ago. I get on my iPad from Santa Cruz. It's the San Jose. And I have a big storm coming. It's early for us to get a big storm. And I'm thinking, oh, God, are our gutters clean? And then we have a big drain in the front of the driveway because we're right next to the road. And the runoff comes from the road and floods our backyard. And I think, God, did my wife remember to clean that? Oh, no. Of course, then it's all the autumn leaves are going to, the first rain, it's going to clog that drain. And so that's a problem. That's how we think of problems. And I think it's a problem from a material point of view, right? The problem is in the leaves, the rain, the drain, right? Okay, that is not what is meant by problem in the Buddhist psychology sense. Okay? It's not denying that that exists. There's some existence there. It's not denying that. But if that was the problem, and I know this gets a little bit simplistic, but, or maybe for most people here, they already know this, but if the leaves were the problem, then everyone would have a problem with the leaves. Just to be simple. Right? But the mail carrier doesn't have any problem with those leaves. See what I'm saying? So then, are the leaves a problem or not? What's the problem? When your neighbor was mowing his lawn at 5 in the morning and waking people up, we will say he's the problem. That's a different, it's very, very, very tough. But as the mind becomes more familiar with reality, which we haven't gotten to yet, problems are seen differently. Okay? Unfortunately, we're not at that part of this presentation. But that's sort of the preview. Because if the material thing, material world, is the problem, is there any solution? So it's pretty fantastic to think about our tax dollars. They go to solving problems. Have they done it yet? No. There's some problems, you know, less than like, you know, illnesses and stuff like that. But generally speaking, I don't think people are that much happier, that much more problem-free. So there's a problem between getting from one side of New York to the other side of New York. So the solution, because the problem is material, you build a bridge. But if you think that solves the problem, then there should be no traffic on that bridge. That's a problem. Now there's a problem with traffic. If you look at any solution, it's so fascinating. Any material solution, it's a problem. It's a new problem. You know, we had all the runoff from the road, so I put a drain. You know, I spent $6,000 put a drain in. Now I'm worried about the drain blocking up. You can't. What does John T. Davis said? You can't cover the world with leather. You have to put on some leather sandals. We accept that, but do we practice that? We're recruited, we're trained, we're habituated into. It's because of the view. So here's the. We're getting there. The clincher is this. We can all say, yeah, you're right, Karuna. Yeah, I get that. Then you go out to your car and you've locked your keys in the car. Where does your mind go? Okay? The problem is the key in the car. I'm so frustrated. I've got to call AAA or whatever you have here. And you call them and they're busy. So you see the problem is they don't have enough staff. Immediately our mind goes back into a material problem. It doesn't mean that those things aren't happening. Don't get me wrong. That's happening. But we think that if we can get AAA on the phone right away, we have no problem. And that's wrong thinking. That thinking is the thinking that Buddhism talks about suffering. Okay, just to clarify, suffering does not mean... We're going to get to it. I don't know what... So we've got to talk about the nature of problems. We do have to talk about it. The narrative therapists and positive psychologists stop talking about it. Because the way it was being described wasn't a solution. Created more problems. So their solution was don't talk about it at all. Which is also not a solution. It's about talking about it in the correct way. A helpful way. And again, I'm trying generalizations like those. I'm not saying those people are all bad and they do bad work and they don't help people. It's just for me to make a point. Okay? I'm saying that because this is being streamed. I'm wondering what all the... If anyone's watching it, then what is he saying? Okay, so yeah. Okay. Crazy Benny is just a regular guy. He's a friend of mine. Slightly older gentleman, retired. Someone I play golf with. Remember I confessed about golf, right? I came clean. Okay. So I remember this vividly. So Benny's retired and Benny's sort of a different political persuasion than me. I won't tell you what I am. I guess. He's the opposite persuasion. And we're friends. It's amazing. He's very, very opinionated, very strong-minded guy. And I remember vividly walking down the 12th fairway with him. And he turned to me and he said something, I don't know what it is about you thinking everything's suffering. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, I read your book. Oh, you did? It's amazing. Benny's very cheap also. what Paul Getty said, by watching the nickels and dimes, the dollars will take care of themselves. I think Benny was of that philosophy. Yeah. And I said, what do you mean you read my book? I was like shocked. He said, yeah, I read it. I said, well, you mean you bought it? Where'd you get it from? He said, no. You just go to Amazon and you click look inside this book.
Oh, yeah.
And I clicked and I read it. And I said, but Benny, said that, you know, it's just part of the... And he says, yeah, it's every other page, but you kind of extrapolate, you know, one page. And he said, you know, and I said, but Benny, I think only the first two chapters are like that, and then the rest of, I don't know, something like that. He said, yeah, but I got the point. Sorry. Benny is a refugee from New York, by the way. Brooklyn. Still has a Brooklyn accent. Lived in California for the last 30 or 40 years, I don't know. I joke with Kondrala because she's from New York. I said to him, I said, well, what do you mean? And he saw it. I said, yeah, I read it. And he says, I don't know. I read about, you're talking about, you know, something about everything suffering. Everyone's suffering. It's a problem. He says, I don't have any problems. I'm suffering. It's okay. He says, look it. You know, I'm a bachelor. I think he's about 72. I'm a bachelor. I have been married 3 times. But I'm happy now. I don't have a wife to answer to. I can play as much golf as I want. I go home. I put, you know, a steak on the grill house. I sit on my beautiful redwood deck. I look out. You know, I got to get home to take care of the water because someone's taking water from our well. But I got to take care of that. So I realized I'd failed in my writing, at least on the pages he read. And I really, you know, somehow I didn't communicate to him when I talked about problems. Yeah. And everyone having problems or suffering, whatever word I use. And I try not to use the word suffering in the book. In general, I try not to, because I don't think it communicates the issue. And I thought, I failed him. You know, I really failed to communicate. I thought, what did I need to say that he would get it? Mm-hmm. So like what you're saying about the ham sandwich, right? People will say, well, you know, I really don't. And there are people, they don't get that upset about that stuff. They don't mind being behind slow drivers in the fast lane. Okay? They're happy to go home and put on something in the oven and sit with a book or watch TV. Like Benny. I'm not, you know, he says, you know, I have my glass of scotch in the evening. You know? Benny, if you met him, a sweet guy, but complains all the time. He's a big complainer. He's complaining, and then right after he's talking about how the group ahead of us is going so slow, and he had to get back home to fix his water line. So I realized I didn't communicate it. But that dialogue we were having is suffering, okay? And now let's take the word suffering out and say it is problematic. And then people will say, well, that's just life. Now, that doesn't really bother me. So I'm thinking, what did I forget? What did I leave out in the description? And I think what's missing is our potential. I think that Benny, like most 99% of people, don't realize what you could have. Doesn't realize what we're missing. It's a lot like people saying, you know, next life I want to come back as my cat. Scares the heck out of me when people say that. But I understand because they think that's problem free. You know, it's just comfort. So it's kind of like comfort, discomfort. Comfort is happiness and discomfort. And then they don't go much deeper. I mean, I don't know how comfortable it is to wake up with all this hair all over your face and these claws, you can't pick up your food, so you got to stick your face in the food. I mean, to me, it sounds like not very comfortable. You know what I mean? Would you like to, like, all of a sudden wake up tomorrow morning? Anyone see the scariest movie I ever saw? Seriously, I think it might be the scariest I ever saw. And this is only going to speak to sort of the older generation. What Walt Disney movie am I talking about? Anyone have an idea? When you were a kid, people used to say Psycho or something. That's Hitchcock. Huh? Bambi? You guys are kind of close.
Dumbo?
Close. The Shaggy Dog. Do you remember that? Yeah. The guy starts growing hair. He wakes up in the morning, he's growing hair like his dog. Remember, and he's driving the car and the dog's sitting next to him. And he's the dog driving. I was about 6 years old. It scared the hell out of me because I thought that could happen. I didn't know. So that was scary. So I don't think any of us, if you could wake up tomorrow morning, some people say, oh, next lifetime, I want to be an eagle. You heard people say that? Anyone heard it? Yeah? Can you imagine? Tomorrow morning, let's just imagine. Right now, tomorrow morning you wake up and you're an eagle. I'm not sure what feels so good about that. Anyway, so I'm digressing, I guess.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, of course. I think we have to think of, the point is think of problems differently, what we mean by problems.
This is probably a trite question, but when
there's no trite questions.
When I'm thinking of problems, you know, you have the problem with the drive-in, like she described. But what about, like, we can't hear you, so you're wearing a microphone? That's a problem.
Yes,
right?
That's a better way of looking at it.
And you need, you're thirsty, so you need water. So that cup solves the problem, yeah. And the well solves the problem.
Mm-hmm.
So you're thirsty, but you go through a series of 50 things to solve the problem of your thirst. Is that the same kind of problem
we're
talking about?
We'll get there right now. Yeah. Yeah. Can't leave you hanging. That's right. To segue into what you're saying, and so that we're all on the same page where we're going, is that one way, sometimes I think it's useful to think that problem is like this. How many of us have control? I think this really speaks a lot to what the problem is. So, number one, we probably can agree pretty quickly we don't have control over the outer world, the material world. Even though science and all these disciplines are designed to somehow get control over the outer world, right? Medicine, engineering, all those, aren't they designed to get control over the outer world? And part of the problem is, now, we can't say, you know, of course, we have to have a job. Probably our job is designed to get some control over the outer world, you know. That doesn't make us wrong or right, bad or good. Again, it comes down to your mindset when you come in. So, of course, you have to earn a living. If you're a nurse, you can do nursing from the point of view is, I'm going to save the world and get rid of all the problems because I'm going to take people care of people's illnesses. Or you can say, you know, that's a wrong way of thinking in the sense that I can't really do that, right? But I'm going to go and help people on that level, but knowing that ultimately I want to awaken everybody because that's the only solution. And I'm getting ahead of myself, but you know that it's something more deeper and long-lasting is really helping people. Doesn't mean you don't go and take care of people's illnesses and, you know, you don't fix roads and that sort of thing. You do. You just do with a different conception. So that's what we're talking about. So it's very important to understand, as an inner being, it's the conception that matters more than what you're doing. I mean, some things are better to do than others. It's better to be a nurse than sell weapons at... Do they sell them at Walmart here? No.
Sure.
Do they? Yeah. Okay. They're selling weapons at Walmart. But on an ultimate point of view, it's not that different. If you're, what makes the difference is your concept. Okay? But it's easier to have a positive concept when you're nursing and helping people or teaching people, being a teacher and stuff, than it is, it's hard when you're in Walmart and selling weapons. It's just harder. It's possible to do. But we're not that strong, so environment does affect us. Very much so. But that's a different topic, okay? So control. Control, now we could start looking at it. That's suffering. That's problematic, is not having control. So, not having control over your hearing. We don't. Not much. Okay? Not having control over your bodily functions. I can't control when I get thirsty or not. Make sense? That's suffering. Because I'm not in control. Something else is. So I'm being controlled. So then you can use the analogy of a prisoner. Is a prisoner, you know, just as a metaphor, a prisoner is going to be less happy than someone who is free. And then extrapolating from that, person who's controlled by all these things, which I'm going to get into in a minute, all these things is less free, less happy. So freedom and happiness are correlated. They're probably synonyms. What if you, for example, What if you had control over your thirst? Can you imagine that? A small thing. We don't have a control over our thirst. What if you did? That'd be like liberating. Wouldn't it?
But you need the drink. You need
to... No, but you have control. That's just, imagine, that's just one small thing. Look at all the things we have no control over. The sound of my voice. Now, we go different. All the material things. We don't have control over. You know, this house could, building could collapse. You know, we don't have control whether this building collapses in 10 minutes or not, do we? We do not. We don't have, now, it gets even worse. We don't have control over whether we have a heart attack in 5 minutes or not. We don't have control whether we have a stroke in 5 minutes or not. We don't have control whether we have an aneurysm in 5 minutes or not. We don't have control whether we get a sharp pain in our stomach in 5 minutes or not. We don't have control, on and on and on, right? We don't have control over our bodies. We think we do, but we don't. So that's not freedom. So not only are we not free from outer things, we're not free from our body. It gets worse. Let's just, for the sake of a point, all of a sudden I could get really rude right now to someone, couldn't I? Just in an instant. I could just say something really mean to somebody here. I'm not going to do it. It's kind of scary, but you know, right? But you could. What happens to your mind? What if I just turned to you and said, you know, I don't think this class is for you. You should, maybe better you leave. Would you have a reaction?
Yeah.
Anyone here not have a reaction? No. That's so small. You don't have, we don't have control over even that small little criticism. So, Can anyone tell me they definitely will not be anxious this afternoon? Can anyone raise their hand and tell me, I definitely know I'm not going to be? That's amazing. Anyone can tell me, I'm definitely not going to be depressed today. I'm definitely not going to get distraught. You might hear any really terrible news. Boom, you're gone. Yeah. I have to be careful, though. I'm not going to repeat what she said because, Yeah, but isn't that amazing? You read the news. A good example. Pick up the newspaper. Boom, the latest thing that some politician has said. Nameless politician. And what happens? You get agitated, right?
Yeah.
Or you get sad. Or you get angry. No control. You just no control. All of a sudden, you read one sentence, and your mood has changed for the day. You hear about Hurricane Matthew. It might be hitting by tomorrow. What was your mind? What happened to you guys when you first heard that news? I guess people's mood changed. Everyone's different, but you became alarmed or worried or yeah. I remember once. I don't know if this is a good example, but I'm going to tell it anyway. I remember once that actually it was the same nun that was leading that course I was telling you about earlier. And she heard about I don't remember who it was, but someone we knew who died, suddenly died. I was living in Nepal. And she ran up to the Lama Dzogchen Rinpoche's room. And she kind of burst in or saw him on the patio and with this distraught look and this panic about this person just died. And Rinpoche started laughing. Not in a nervous way, you know. Some of us could do that. He's like, he was just, something was there. I think maybe the way she saw the situation as permanent, self-existent and dire, whatever. I don't know. He saw something different. Mm-hmm. His mind didn't move. You know, here's a good example. Some years ago, Rinpoche, as Lama Yeshe was still alive, I think, yeah, Rinpoche and Lama Yeshe were visiting. They took a little break. One student has a house. They were up in the Boston area, and this one student has a house, like a weekend house or summer house out on the lake or somewhere. And they invited them, to have some relaxation. They went out to the house for the weekend to relax, and I think there were several people, of course, there. Lama Yeshe loves swimming. He literally loves swimming. And so they decided to go for a dip in the lake. And Rinpoche went as well, and they're all, kind of splashing around the lake. And then at a certain point, someone says, "Where's Rinpoche?" And looking around, and a little further out, they saw a hand, just a hand, above the surface of the water. And it was going... And all of a sudden, the realization, Rinpoche doesn't know how to swim. So my friend swam out there and saved his life. But when he dove in to get... Rinpoche was just like, here I am, something like that. And he brought him to the surface, took him in. And Rinpoche was kind of giggling, not nervous, no panic. No problem. Okay, no problem. Because you have control over the mind, even death comes, no problem. Didn't matter. I mean, I say it didn't matter. I say that, with quotes around. I'm not sure if it didn't matter in some ways. But it didn't matter to him, emotionally. Okay? So that's where the difference between problem, control. So I think that's control. So I think our big problem is lack of control. And the opposite of control is problems, is suffering, let's say. Okay? So if you think, what's the opposite? So that would mean right now, are we in suffering? Well, let me ask you, are you in control? Not really. Because we're just on the brink of loss of control, aren't we? Tiny thing could happen. So that must mean, in fact, even though in a second we could get depressed or we could have a heart attack, that must, by extension, means we're not in control right now either. Even though we might not be obviously experiencing a problem, we're in the state of being able to experience a problem. So it's not really much different. We're not in control.
Rather than use the word problems, what Geshe-la has begun using is the word complications.
Whatever works.
No, I just,
It is complications. It's complicated.
Unending.
Yeah, unending complications. Whatever works for you. To get the idea across that it's this, it's a state of vulnerability. Now, if you take it even further, when we get more sensitive, it's not only that state of vulnerability that we're in this instant is, as we get more sensitive, feels problematic. It feels like suffering. Okay? In juxtaposition to the what we could be. So, let me see what my next slide is. Yeah. This is just review of this thing. So that's about the truth of self. So, why did Buddha? So it's interesting. I had to, as a psychology student and therapist, when you learn a psychological theory or a psychotherapeutic theory, it isn't really presented in the way that Buddha presented the problem. Buddha presented the problem as the Four Noble Truths. It was his first teaching. So Buddha, after attaining enlightenment under the Bodhi tree, I'm paraphrasing. He sort of said, "No one will get this. It's inexpressible. It's no use for me to try and explain it to anybody." So he wandered around in silence for 6 weeks. But then he was implored, "Please teach us what you found." And finally, after, the gods begged him, and he said, "Okay." So that's the point, was that it was so hard. And then the first thing he taught was the Four Noble Truths. And so, as a Westerner, and maybe as a student of psychology, you think, well, why would he teach the truth of suffering first? It's kind of negative, kind of a downer. Why don't you teach us about the awakened mind for the truth of an end, which is the cessation of suffering, technically. These are not the technical terms, but, the truth of cessation, number three. That's really, that sounds pretty exciting. Sounds pretty cool, and, I like that. He didn't teach that first. Interesting, isn't it? So I believe that, of course, that he did this for a reason. And so when I look at other systems or modalities to help people out of suffering, I think about this. I'm not saying it has to always follow these four. I just think for myself, I thought, well, this is interesting that he organized it this way. So I think the truth of suffering or the truth of problems is that we have to become very versed in what our situation is, and see that the situation is suffering or problematic, you know, from the point of view of what our potential is. Our potential is number three up there. Okay? There is this state of being that is, that we call enlightenment or awakened, that must be really, really, really fantastic. You know? And so why not look at that? You know, it's a little bit like, I think when these, so look at it like this. If you think of your dog or cat, do you think it's in as good a state as you are? I mean, I don't think we think that, right? We think, for lack of a better word, just make one, it's suffering more than me. You know, I wouldn't want to be my cat. I wouldn't want to be my dog. You know, and you can test that many ways. Like you can, when you left, did you tell your cat to put the food in the oven for that when you come back it'll be warm? You can't do that, right? It doesn't have the capacity, not only physically but mentally, to understand what you're saying. Or did you just say, you know, just stay right on the bed today, don't move anywhere else? And it might do it, but it might not. It's not going to do it because you said. Okay? I love those pictures on YouTube where the dog goes crazy when they leave the house. They're so funny. So from the point of view of looking at your dog or cat, you would think it's suffering. You can tell it many things. You can say, you know, meditate for 1 hour a day. It can't understand you. That must be what it's like for someone like these more advanced spiritual beings looking at us. Over and over again, they tell you, this is suffering, don't do that. And yet we do it again. We don't get it. I think our motivation is different than the dog. The dog can't even have the motivation. But, you know, from the point of view of, so they're coming from the point of view of this awakened mind. And it's such a happy place to be. They just want us to be there so badly. Just like when your dog or cat, you know, you really would want it to understand, but you can't get through to it. The difference with those awakened beings and us is they see that we have the potential. They won't spend the same kind of effort on a cat because it doesn't have the capacity, for the most part, to change its mentality like we do. So it has the awakened potential just like we do, but the big difference is we can really do something about it. Cat can't do that. Okay. Hamster can't do that. Chipmunk can't do that. Okay? And many, many human beings can't do it, probably. When you really, I mean, it's very tough. Depending on conditions, right? Because the conditions for human beings, for the most part, really are very, very, very difficult. We're the lucky ones. And we're what represent maybe what percent of the population of the world? 1%? I don't even know if it's that many. That much. Right? Very small. Maybe it's not even measurable almost.
You mean Buddhists?
Who have the potential and have interest, yeah. They have the potential. Like, I think a lot of people, you know, even though I might have the interest, they can't because of their physical situation. You know, they got to work and they can't figure out how to get to teachings and study this and get the ideas, or maybe they don't know how to read, like that. It's a lot of the world's like that. Yeah. So the difference here. So you know why these are called the Four Noble Truths? Interested to know? People have been studying this, and then they Four Noble Truths. Why do they call them noble?
Because
I only, by the way, I only learned this a few years ago. I didn't know. So it's something different. Any guesses why it's noble truths?
Because they lead to enlightenment?
No. They do, but that's not why the word noble is there. Why the word noble? Why not just four truths?
They don't react with other elements? No, I just...
Susan?
The person hearing this has to have certain qualities to be able to understand or get anything from it. Well, is that right?
I'm not going to tell you till you say it.
The hearer of this has to have some qualities to be able to understand it or receive it.
Uh-huh. Okay. You're right. I didn't know that. So the reason called noble truths is noble is the English translation for the word arya. An arya being as someone who's had direct insight into reality. When we have that direct insight into reality, okay, so for the sake of Jim, they're noble, Jim, because of... He's coming in. They're noble because... I'm going to ask him. He wasn't here, okay? Why are these called the four noble truths? Why noble?
Why noble? I guess because they're important.
Ah, okay. They are important. Isn't it funny? I mean, Susan's right, but you know, we've been studying a long time. The reason called noble is because of the... when you attain insight into emptiness or into reality, you become an arya being. An arya being is a Sanskrit word, arya, and it's usually translated as noble person, noble being. So when we have direct insight into reality, we see these four things finally. So, you know, when I look out at you, and you look at me, and you go through your world, and we might intellectually say, okay, I know this is suffering. But we don't actually see it as suffering. Not in the way that it's meant. Okay, we might see glimpses of it, like we might see people looking, they seem very sad, or they seem not in control, or, you know, ignorant because they don't know these ideas. It's like that. You know, we deepen our understanding of it. But we're not actually understanding the first noble truth, or these four. And by the way, when the arya being has insight into emptiness or reality, he or she sees all four of these. They're all make sense. Okay. And of course, and then we'll, in terms of meditation or insight, might jump around between them. That's a different, emphasize, I should say, not jump around. But certain ones might be emphasized where his or her point of view might be really focused on the suffering, for really get overwhelmed by seeing it. But then other times get overwhelmed by, Astra has insight into the third one. Enlightenment has a perception of that. Does not necessarily attain enlightenment, but has perception of that reality. We don't really, if you're like me, you don't really have a perception of enlightenment. You have a belief in it. Mm-hmm. Okay? And as we believe more, we might have little insights that reaffirm it, or big insights. And so, but finally, over time, when we become healthier and healthier and healthier, we will have a direct, non-conceptual perception or experience of reality, emptiness. And then you have conviction in these four. Because you have experience, maybe convictions. You're so convinced because you have direct experience. It's the way it is. So I think right now the way it is, we don't really know that the way it is suffering or problematic. Okay? I think it's noon. Noon 01. I hope this is helpful. You know, one thing I was thinking about when I do these classes in this Muslim, and often do at Buddhist centers, I do outside too. When you do outside Buddhist center, I have to take more. I have to give more explanation. You know, and of course, in a Buddhist center, people are familiar with these ideas for the most part. But then I get concerned in the Buddhist centers that it's too simplistic. It's too basic, many. Do people have that experience? You older students?
We're all at different levels, dear.
Thank you, Lama. Okay, I just don't want to, you know, I don't want to leave anybody out. So those advanced students, I don't want to leave them out either. So I hope I'm not. I don't know.
It's always helpful to go back to the basics.
Mm-hmm. I think so, for me. But, I, you know, again, I want to be helpful, I hope. And so let me know if there's any, also as we go on, you know, for some people, if there's particular areas. You know, part of my intention for those maybe older students or more, not older, like age older. I'm sorry. I remember someone saying, oh, you're an older student. I said, thanks a lot. I think you're supposed to say elder or something. I don't know. Is also, I hope that this gives you some content for or ideas in terms of explaining these ideas to your friends and parents and children and things like that. Okay, so whether the idea itself might not be that new, but the expression of it. So if that's helpful, that's what we're looking for. Okay, okay. So we're meeting again at 1:30, and. 1:30 to 4. Maybe we'll have a break in there somewhere because it's long session. Okay? And then just before you leave, sir. It might be interesting to have a little bit of awareness for the next hour and a half. And the awareness would be being aware of your mind, the state of your mind as you go through the next hour and a half, a couple times even. And then think about how that state of mind, whether it's problematic or not, or suffering or not, whatever you want to use, okay? Just get a familiarity. Okay? Thank you.